Good afternoon. It's 6 minutes after 12, and this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, October 14th, 2019. You're listening to 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead this hour, we meet the new chief of police in Fort Smith, Danny Baker. He was sworn in Friday morning, and Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke to him after that ceremony. And after our program, it will be time for NPR's Here and Now. Today, will Texas turn blue in 2020? It could be up to Latinos, who are expected to become the largest population group in Texas by 2020. Plus, what if instead of waiting until someone dies to celebrate them, you memorialize them while they're still alive? Living funerals on Here and Now, beginning at 1 on 91.3. The University of Arkansas Symphony performs tonight in the Faulkner Performing Arts Center on the UA campus. The symphony, under the direction of Robert Mueller, will play works by Beethoven, Mueller, and Wagner. Tickets for the concert are $10 for general admission, $5 for students, faculty, and seniors. The concert scheduled to begin at 7:30. This is Ozarks at Large. The Hispanic Women's Organization of Arkansas hosted its annual conference at the Jones Center in Springdale Friday. Stephen Dillingham, director of the U.S. Census Bureau, was one of the event's featured speakers. While he was in Northwest Arkansas, he hosted a press conference with Fort Smith Mayor George McGill to talk about the 2020 census. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
It is a civic responsibility. Everyone is supposed to complete the census.
In addition to civic responsibility, Census Director Stephen Dillingham says it's important to participate because collecting an accurate count can benefit a community.
It's important to know how important it is because all these individuals are members of groups that stand to profit. They need to be counted so their communities, so the schools plan for their children and all the services, the government services, reach their community. So the downside would be if they're not all counted, then they're missing out on resources, they're missing out on services that they otherwise would get.
Fort Smith Mayor George McGill is chairman of the statewide Complete Count Committee, a group dedicated to spreading awareness about the 2020 census. One way Mayor McGill says they're doing that is by displaying information about the census on a vehicle that will travel around the state.
We're very excited about this. We're going to make it fun, and we're going to get this vehicle out and about before the census is being taken so people will be familiar with it. And we'll recognize it and be willing to get on it. We're going to have the kiosk on this vehicle. And so we're going to make the best of the best.
Census Director Stephen Dillingham says this is the first vehicle he's seen like this in the country. Arkansas traditionally has had a lower self-response rate, and he says they want to turn that around. One of the challenges to getting an accurate count, Dillingham says, is engaging hard-to-reach and hard-to-count communities. For example, he says counting children has been a perennial issue.
And we're training our people to ask specific questions. Are there any other children living in the house? But sometimes households may be blended families. Sometimes the children may be staying with other relatives or other guardians, and they sometimes forget to include all the children. So that's one of the populations, very important. But we also have some language barriers. And here in Arkansas, there's the diversity is changing, and we have some language needs that we need to address. And one of the important things about the census is we're addressing that better than ever before.
Dillingham says the Census Bureau offers assistance on the phone in 13 languages. The organization also provides materials in 59 languages. There can be distrust among some groups, like immigrants, about sharing their personal information, but Dillingham assures it is a confidential process.
We at the Census Bureau by federal law, cannot share the information, any personal information, to anyone, any law enforcement agency whatsoever. The only thing we can do with it is produce numbers, aggregate numbers, statistics, population statistics. So that's our work. That's what the federal law, and if we violate it, we go to prison for a long time. And we pay fines that we can't afford, $250,000.
The 2020 census will be the first time people can respond online. However, they can also fill out a paper form or make a phone call. Dillingham says the information systems are state-of-the-art, and the Census Bureau is working with several organizations to ensure the information is protected.
And the minute, even when a census taker comes by and collects it, puts it in their device, it's encrypted, and it goes behind a wall where it's protected. Now, 72 years later, after we do the census, you can go look up your information, but it's protected for 72 years. But it is important, as was pointed out, that everyone understands this and all the communities understand this.
As they prepare for next year's census, officials are looking to hire up to 500,000 census takers. In Arkansas, the part-time job pays $14 an hour.
These jobs are great jobs, and it gives you great experience as a federal employee. You will receive training if you're selected, but to hire 500,000 people, the largest civilian hiring mobilization effort since World War II, to do that, we want to have about 2.7 million applicants.
The next census is scheduled for April 1st, 2020. More information is available at 2020census.gov. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Fort Smith's new police chief was sworn in Friday morning at the District Courts building.
Hi, Danny Baker.
Do solemnly swear or affirm.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
And that I will support the Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Arkansas.
And the Constitution of the State of Arkansas.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
And that I will faithfully discharge the duties.
As Chief of Police of the City of Fort Smith, Arkansas.
As Chief of Police of the City of Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Upon which I'm about to enter.
Upon which I'm about to enter.
Danny Baker was picked for the position after serving as interim chief for 6 months, following former Chief Nathaniel Clark's departure in May. City Administrator Carl Gefkin praised his performance during that time.
He's gone through much during his interim period, and he's come out the other side, still holding true to community-oriented policing, to wanting to serve the city of Fort Smith, and to give everything he can to the police department.
After the ceremony, Chief Baker spoke with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek. She has more about his vision for the police department's future.
Danny Baker is a veteran of the Fort Smith Police Department. He started working there in 2001 as a patrol officer and made his way through the ranks, first as sergeant, then as captain, and eventually deputy police chief. It's a story he shared during his swearing-in ceremony.
I'm not the most highly educated, most decorated, or the most tenured police administrator that you could have hired. I don't have a long list of letters after my name. I've made mistakes, and I'm going to make more. But what I can promise you with absolute certainty is that what I do have is heart and a willingness to be open and contrite when I come face to face with my shortcomings.
Baker tells us he's always felt like he was right where he needed to be at the time, especially when former Chief Kevin Lindsay resigned after being accused of making racial remarks in front of a city employee. In January 2017, Lindsay was replaced by Nathaniel Clark, the first African-American to lead the city's police department. Baker says a lot of officers left the force, which left them with 40 vacant positions.
I found myself looking around with nobody to tell me how I needed to behave and how I needed to help make sure that this organization succeeded. And I realized then that all these things that have been lining up in my life were pushing me to this point where, I mean, I believe that I and others were placed where we were in a certain period of time to make sure that the department was successful.
During his tenure, Clark created a 7-year strategic plan focused on 21st century policing, a term that comes from an Obama administration report compiled by a task force established in response to the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, following the shooting of Michael Brown. Baker says he intends to continue what Clark started and instill the 6 pillars of 21st century policing in his department.
There were a lot of things going on around the country that a lot of people were worried, myself included. I mean, we see things like, you know, Ferguson, Missouri, and we see things like Baltimore, Maryland, and the way that the distrust in the police and how the communities were rising up against their police departments. And as one who had been in the business for, you know, a number of years, I was having a hard time understanding why this was happening.
Up until that point, Baker says, the police department believed racial tensions were not an issue in Fort Smith.
There was no white people or no black people or people of color that were saying that. All those the folks that were saying that were white folks. There was obviously issues because we had a demonstration or a peace march when Sandra Bland, I think she died in custody in Texas, in a town in Texas. But we had the demonstration in Fort Smith, and that really kind of opened my eyes to say, you know, maybe I'm not looking at this the right way. Maybe I need to start trying to look at it through a different set of lenses.
Baker says reading the 21st Century Policing Report was a turning point in his career. It helped him understand the department needed to do more to address its issues and connect with the community where it enforced the law.
First time I picked that thing up, I'm like, you know, that's exactly what we need to be doing. I mean, that's the answer. I mean, these are the things that we need to be implementing as police, and not just Fort Smith, but across the nation, to start working on some of these issues that are causing things like I'm seeing in other parts of the country and that I absolutely do not want to see in Fort Smith, Arkansas.
To better connect with the community, Baker says, the police force needs to reflect its diversity. According to our partners, Talk Business and Politics, since 2016, the Fort Smith PD increased its number of black officers from 1 to 4%. Its number of Hispanic officers went up by 2 points to 7%, and women now make up about 8% of the force compared to 5%. Baker says he will continue building on those strides.
Let me go back to the way law enforcement used to think. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily wrong, but this is just the playbook that we were given. We are police officers. We enforce the law, and that's it. But the reality of that mentality is, number one, we're not robots. We're human beings. The community expects us to be more than that now. They expect us to interact on personal levels, and they expect us to be problem solvers, not just law enforcers. And to do that, we have to have people of different cultures and different backgrounds and different experiences in our ranks.
Baker says connecting with the community also means taking responsibility for when things go wrong. Baker was in the interim chief position when Deborah Stevens drowned after floodwaters overtook her SUV the morning of August 24th. A 22-minute call with a dispatcher during her ordeal has been described as calloused and uncaring. At one point, the dispatcher scolds Stevens for driving into the water and tells her to shut up. Baker says it was a tragic accident, but the call shouldn't have been handled that way.
And when we can finally put all that out there on the table, I think folks will see that there's just a whole lot of things that transpired that resulted in Miss Stevens' death. And it's terrible that it happened. But I will say this, there are things that we can improve on. There are a lot of things that we need to do differently, and many of them center around the fact that we don't have enough people. I mean, we just simply do not have enough people to handle the number of calls and the number of things that we have to deal with.
Baker says dispatchers are frustrated and overworked with no time to decompress after an entire shift of walking people through traumatic experiences.
There's a need for the people in there to feel valued and know that they're important and know that they have an outlet. I think for whatever reason, somehow the people in that room have become, they feel like they're on an island by themselves. And, you know, I'm going to have to do what I can to fix that.
Part of that plan, Baker says, needs to include more supervision in the dispatch center, especially during second and third shifts. The other part involves the steps that have been taken to reduce rudeness complaints against police officers. Baker says patrol officers are now required to interact with the community in non-enforcement roles. They also wear body cameras.
There's a big red light on the front of that thing, and it tells them, my conversation, my interaction is being recorded. And that changes the dynamics of the interaction. It changes the dynamics from the officer. It changes the dynamics from the citizen. When both know that their contact is being recorded, that changes the way they interact with people. It makes them necessarily nicer.
Baker says he'd like to implement more community involvement and a tangible reminder of being recorded in the dispatch department.
Maybe something in that room that is a constant reminder that, hey, everything I'm saying right now, everything I'm doing is being recorded, and it could wind up on, you know, tomorrow's headline. So I think that if maybe we can translate those two things into the dispatch, I think that will be helpful.
The new chief also wants to approach city leaders for increased pay for hourly employees. And as he takes over, Baker says the department is in better shape than it was in 2017. Of the 164 sworn positions, 151 of them are filled.
Patrol is the priority. I've restructured the department a couple of months ago, moved a whole lot of positions out of administration, but I increased the number of positions in patrol from 99 to 110. So just using what we've got, I've boosted the number of positions in patrol. So what that translates into is that there will be more uniformed police officers on the streets.
And if he can fill more positions, Baker says he has a vision for a crisis stabilization unit within the department that could specifically handle calls that have to do with mental health and substance abuse, as well as a host of other types of crises.
If we have somebody or a group of officers that deal with that sort of problem on a daily basis, and they know this individual on a first name basis, they know what their problem is, they know what their substance of choice is. I mean, once again, having that intimate relationship with that particular person and that particular problem, I think that's going to free up resources for us. It will allow us to address the problem the best way that we can.
Baker says he sees himself as a servant of the people of Fort Smith, and he wants his officers and staff to feel the same way so they can continue building a department that the city can be proud of.
I used to be worried about change and things that, you know, I didn't understand. I've learned to embrace that, because what we have on the other side of it, when we go through difficulties and things like the department experienced, when we come through that, we come through better.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
And still to come on our Monday show, why Kristen Kaufman, writer, Arkansas native, and self-described recovering corporate executive, thinks there are no incidental occurrences.
So even those experiences that at the time may not feel like they're positive, when you look back at them retrospectively, 9 times out of 10, they absolutely were positive. They were happening for us, not to us.
A conversation with Kristen Kaufman about her new book, Is This Seat Taken? No, I saved it for you, in about 3 minutes on today's Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. Experts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggest all children, including babies and toddlers, should be vaccinated for the flu by the end of this month. Dr. Chad Rogers is a pediatrician at Little Rock Pediatric Clinic. He says early vaccinations help stave off more than just the flu.
The kids, you know, have never been exposed to the flu before, and they're kind of developing their immunity. So that first time they get the flu, it can hit them pretty hard, and that kind of lowers their immune system because it's fighting the flu. So then it's kind of, they can't fight off other things, and they're more likely to get the complications like ear infections and pneumonia, and sometimes getting kind of seriously ill.
Dr. Rogers says newborns are immune if their mother has been vaccinated, but over the first 6 months of life, that immunity goes away.
But around 6 months of age, we want that baby to begin to build their immunity. So we start giving the flu shot as early as 6 months of age, and we really encourage kids who are 6 months to 2 years of age to get that vaccination.
New annual flu vaccines are developed each year based on viruses predicted to be most common for that season. But Dr. Rogers says young children, ages 6 to 18 months, should be vaccinated twice to help establish immunity.
So the first year that you get a flu shot, that kids should get a booster. So it's very important that if it's their first year to get a flu shot, that they get one at least 4 weeks later.
Flu shots are available through local health care units, primary care clinics, pharmacies, and community centers. Our Kids First, the children's health insurance program, covers flu shots for Arkansas children at no cost. It's expected to be clear tonight throughout the region, lows in the lower to mid-50s. Tomorrow, sunny with highs in the upper 70s in northwest Arkansas. A slight chance of thundershowers tomorrow afternoon in the Arkansas River Valley, also with highs in the upper 70s. And our early forecast for the weekend, highs in the upper 70s around the region, slight chance of rain for Fort Smith in the Arkansas River Valley. And don't forget, you can take Ozarks at Large with you no matter the weather by subscribing to our free podcast. Services like Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Apple TV, and TuneIn offer the podcast. And you can listen to the show by asking your smart speaker to play Ozarks at Large through TuneIn. And you can find entire editions of the show and individual stories and interviews at OzarksAtLarge.com.
Little Wing Productions presents American singer-songwriter Don McLean and his Bye Bye Miss American Pie tour to the Auditorium in Eureka Springs on Friday, October 18th. This Songwriter Hall of Fame inductee is known for songs Vincent, Starry Starry Night, and I Love You So, and others. 888-695-0888 or theauditorium.org for tickets and information. The Rave Cultural Foundation presents the strings concert Prayag, a confluence of two distinct styles of Indian classical music, Saturday, October 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Old High Middle School in Bentonville. Tickets and information on this concert available at Facebook/RAVE Cultural Foundation.
This is Ozarks at Large. Kristen Kaufman calls herself a recovering corporate executive. The Arkansas native and University of Arkansas graduate now lives in Dallas, Texas, and is the founder of Alignment Incorporated, which assists people finding alignment with themselves and their organizations. This month, a third and final book in her series, Is This Seat Taken?, is available. The book, Is This Seat Taken? No, I Saved It For You, encourages readers to learn from everyday experiences. Recently, Kristen Kaufman came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss her most recent book. She says she doesn't think we should ignore random events that take place in our lives.
I don't believe that incidental encounters are incidental at all. So even those experiences that at the time may not feel like they're positive, when you look back at them retrospectively, 9 times out of 10, they absolutely were positive. They were happening for us, not to us. Right, to teach us something, for example.
But to do that, you have to be willing and aware enough to look back and examine.
Absolutely. I mean, I have an adage, you have to be present to win, right? And so that means present in the moment, but also to your point, have enough attention to what you've gone through and to be reflective as to what was I supposed to learn from this, or perhaps what was I supposed to teach? It's not just you learning. You could also be teaching through that experience.
This can apply to an experience that, let's say, is wonderful.
Yes.
You're walking down the street, the concert is sold out, a stranger comes up to you and says, hey, I've got an extra, would you like to go? That's great, right?
Right.
What about something that isn't so great? You're trying to work with someone on the phone to fix an IT problem.
Right.
You're not talking the same language, you can feel temperatures rising, stress rising, and it doesn't go completely well.
Right.
How do you learn from that?
So, well, I can speak to several of the chapters in this third book. I write about an abusive relationship that I was in.
Oh, see, that's much more severe than what I'm talking about.
I write about a terminal diagnosis that I was given.
Again.
It ended up not being terminal, but it could have been. And I was very vulnerable. I would say, Kyle, probably one of the big distinctions of this last book in the trilogy is how vulnerable I am. I completely opened my kimono in these stories because I felt like I was called to do that. So I don't hide behind the happy hummingbird roses stories. I actually go there with these stories that were pretty life-altering.
But that's great because there are people in abusive relationships.
That's right.
That need to see that somebody was in one.
Yes.
And emerged.
Absolutely. And so I go there. And in fact, several of my friends and my sweet sister who had not read the book until, you know, I got the actual galley copies, And she came to me. She said, "Kristen, these are so vulnerable. These stories are so vulnerable. Are you sure you want to go public with them?" And I said, "Absolutely," because, like I said, I felt very called to do that for the same reasons that you just mentioned. There are people, I am quite certain, that will read this book and say, "Wow, wow, what a way to look at it," or "Wow, look at how she spun that, you know, so that she, you know, has a different perspective on it."
Go as far with this question as you want.
Okay.
What can, what did you, what could you learn from being in an abusive relationship?
I learned that, well, I use a metaphor in this story. And the story is about the clinical psychologist that I was visiting after I made the decision to get out of this abusive relationship. She was a Jungian analyst and became a very dear friend and mentor. And we talked about the notion of being whole. And being whole does not mean perfect. It means all of you, your shadow side, as well as your good bits, if you will. And the metaphor that I use is that wonderful Japanese art form called golden joinery, where Japanese potters and artists, if they would break a vase or some piece of pottery, rather than to throw it out, they would actually fill those cracks with gold. And then these pots became beautiful through their imperfection. And it's the same thing with us as human beings. We are really more beautiful when we integrate our imperfections and our human condition. And so that's what that story highlights.
You mentioned that the clinical psychologist was Jungian.
Yes.
You also mentioned earlier in our conversation that you didn't believe in any random.
No.
So no coincidences. Isn't that somewhat Jungian too?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Well, just being present, mm-hmm. you know, it's a very Zen perspective, being present in the moment, being awake to these incidental encounters that really are not incidental. What am I supposed to be learning from this? What am I supposed to be teaching from in this experience? Or how am I supposed to be serving? Because I'm a huge believer that the primary reasons why we're on the planet are to teach each other, to learn from one another, to serve, all wrapped up with love. And that's really what I believe is the magic of life. And yes, Carl Jung, absolutely, as well as Joseph Campbell and many other, you know, people that I've studied, believe as well.
Are there exercises to be more present?
Well, it's interesting. At the end of this book, I actually responded to a lot of the feedback that I had from my readers of the prior two books. I actually have a little workbook that I include questionnaires. I include tips on how to become more present, how to be awake to what is going on around you, how to create your manifesto for your life. And so to answer your question, yes, there are tips, and I'm kind of excited about that because it's the last part of this book.
Can you give us just one tip? Don't give everything away, but just something.
Oh, sure.
That will
okay,
tease
so you
bit.
Probably are familiar with have you ever watched the author the Actors Studio?
Oh,
with
yes.
Jim Lipton?
Yes.
Okay. So I include questions.
With the cards. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yes. So I include, for example, his questionnaire along with my questionnaire. And what it does is it forces people to become awake and aware of what they want, how they want to create their life. And a lot of people are on autopilot, Kyle. I mean, they're just not taking the reins, so to speak. And so this helps us to peel back our own layers, figure out what it is that we want, and then how we can go about creating it. So the questionnaire is one tip for sure, and I think it's the first tip.
Okay. You mentioned that you're very vulnerable in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think without writing the first two Is This Seat Taken books in this trilogy, you would have been as vulnerable?
No. Great question. No. The first book was very cathartic in many ways because I had been collecting those stories over the decades that I'd been a global road warrior when I was a senior executive with several technology companies. They were collections of stories that I'd been keeping in these journals over the years. So that book was very cathartic in that I was able to finally share these stories of these, what I call these magical teachers that just showed up in my life. There is no way that I would have had the courage to be as vulnerable had I not written these two books before. This book really puts me out there. It really does.
Was there ever in the process a second guess about that?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, there were a couple of times when I was writing, I was thinking, man, do I really want to go here? So what I always ask myself, what is my intention for sharing this story? And not there's not one story in this book that is a self-grandiose approach to the story. It's all in the service of the reader and what the reader could learn or glean. In fact, there's this chapter in the book called Gleaning, what they could glean from that experience. And I think it forced me and it called me, to use the other term I used, to be vulnerable. Because had I not been vulnerable, I don't think the stories would have had the impact. You know, there's a lot of power in vulnerability, really.
Yeah, but
you have to be brave.
There's some risk, too.
There's totally some risk. I mean, I am confident that there are people that I have known my entire life that are going to read something in this book and say, I had no idea that that went on.
I can't remember if I've read this about you or you and I have said this in our previous visits and conversations, but I think there's a term you use as recovering corporate executive.
I'm a recovering corporate executive. Yes, I am. Yes.
And I bring that up because some people from the outside, when they look at your career, would say, you were living the life.
Yeah.
Right? You were high profile, a mover, a shaker.
Yes, I was.
How, I would think that that would be hard to let go of.
Well, you know, it's sort of like a divorce, I guess. I've never been married, but I guess it's a little bit like a divorce. Like, you know, I mean, I use the term, I lost the plot, and mm-hmm. I did. I lost the plot. What fulfilled me in my early part of my career was no longer fulfilling for me anymore. It just wasn't. It didn't turn me on. I was out of alignment, to use my term. You know, alignment is when you love what you do and you're good at it, but most importantly, it's tied to something greater than yourself. And if any one of those three pillars are out of whack, then you're wobbly. And I think I still was good at what I did, but frankly, I wasn't loving it anymore.
And it comes back to this awareness.
Being
aware.
No question.
Because you were still good at what you did, but we're not always the best at being aware that we're unhappy. You can be in denial.
Yes, but we evolve. As human beings, we evolve. We are not static. Mm-hmm. We're not static. So what worked for us 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, in all likelihood, is probably not going to continue to work for us in the same way. We're going to have to shift things up. And the name of the game is to be brave. As my mother would say, rise up on your hind legs. You know, rise up on your hind legs and tackle your life.
All right, Kristen, so the trilogy, three books. Trilogy usually means that's it. What's next?
Well, there will be other books. I'm not really sure how or what, but there definitely will be other books. They're kind of already percolating.
Thanks so much for coming in.
I loved it. I love seeing you again. Thank you.
Well, come back with the next book, whatever it is.
Okay, awesome. All thanks. Right. Thank you.
Kristen Kaufman's new book, Is This Seat Taken? No, I Saved It For You, is available in bookstores and online now. She is an Arkansas native and graduate of the University of Arkansas and now lives in Dallas, Texas. You can find out more about her and her books at kristenkaufman.com.
What new compound was discovered on Titan? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. Titan, Saturn's largest moon, is a carbon-rich, oxygen-poor world with a wide range of chemical compounds, organic and inorganic alike, from its cold liquid lakes to its hazy atmosphere. Titan's compound melting pot is considered to be a look into our past. That Titan may look like what a primordial Earth may have been in the early stages of the solar system. With it being carbon-rich, many types of compounds can form. An example is methane, which when struck by solar radiation, it can be broken apart and connect to other atoms and form other compounds, like chemical Legos. Propane, one of the lightest members of the carbon family, was first detected in Titan's atmosphere during NASA's Voyager 1 flyby in 1980. Propane's isomer, or rather the same chemicals assembled in a different way to make a completely different compound, is called propidine. Propidine has been predicted to be present in Titan's atmosphere for several decades, stated University of Maryland researcher Nicholas Lombardo and colleagues. In August 2019, the first detection has finally been made of propine and propidine using NASA's infrared telescope facility. This marks the first isomer pair detected, and hope that many more weird and outstanding chemical compounds may be detected in the near future. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with your host, Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM, KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. This is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas.
It's Monday, the 14th day of October. We've made it to the middle of the month, and helping us get to the other side of October is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
Actually, what I'm trying to figure out how to do is sneak out of the office and get out to do one of my favorite things. It's Crafts Fair Week.
First rule of sneaking out of the office is
don't announce it on public radio. Yeah, there's that. Well, my mother-in-law and I used to sneak out and go to the crafts fairs, and we had a saying about funnel cake basket t-shirt.
Meaning you'd get a funnel cake, get another one.
Get a funnel cake, do some shopping, get another one.
And what's the basket?
Oh, well, everybody sells Ozark baskets.
Gotcha. And then the shirt is, I get
Yeah,
that.
And everybody buys a t-shirt.
Now, let me ask this about the shirts. I've only been to the craft fair like once or twice.
And we're held hostage at that moment.
No. I enjoyed myself. I went of my own free will. Do they make shirts like, can you this year get the 2019 craft
fair shirt? As a matter of fact, you can.
Just like Mike's Blues and Barbecue or any festival? Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Somewhere.
Is there a theme?
No.
Okay.
No, but somewhere in my mother-in-law's closet, which probably hasn't been completely cleared out yet, there are many years of t-shirts. It's a wonderful, happy thing.
Now, it's a weekend thing, but it begins before the weekend.
It does begin. It begins on the 16th, which is what, Wednesday?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it starts with Spanker Creek, which is up in Bella Vista, on the Bella Vista-Bentonville line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's outdoors, couple of hundred booths, some food, beautiful location with the bluffs on one side and the creek on the other side. And that starts at 8 o'clock on Wednesday.
Okay.
Goes through Sunday. Mm-hmm. The Bella Vista Arts and Crafts Festival, which is one of the older ones and one of the really high-quality traditional crafts ones, has a couple of hundred exhibitors. It starts on Thursday, but it's only Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
No Sunday.
Ozark Regional Arts and Crafts Festival. Now, this is indoors. This is good. 28 years at the Northwest Arkansas Convention Center in Springdale and 6 years at the Washington County Fairgrounds in Fayetteville and a total of more than 650 booths.
And is it the fairgrounds now?
Get good shoes. It's both places.
Oh, it's both places.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's from the 17th through the 19th at both places.
All right.
And then there's the War Eagle Fair.
Now, that's the granddaddy, right?
That's the one that's responsible.
Okay.
It is actually not the granddaddy.
Oh.
The Clothesline Fair in Prairie Grove.
But that's not the same time.
No. But it's actually older.
Sure. But this is the one that of this specific weekend. Yes.
In 1954.
Wow.
It started as essentially a quilt show on the banks of War Eagle.
Oh, I should know this, but that's before Beaver Dam, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the mill was there, but I don't know that it was open at the time. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the thing about the War Eagle Fairs. There's actually three at the same time on the same weekend.
Okay.
The first one you get to, if you come from Springdale, is the War Eagle Fair at War Eagle Mills Farm.
Okay.
That's the one that's the granddaddy of all of them. And it is Thursday through Sunday. But across the bridge, the cool old bridge, is the War Eagle Mill Crafts Fair, which is the little fair in the mill yard at War Eagle Mill. And you can go inside and get ham and beans. And and then behind the mill is Sharp's Show of War Eagle.
Right.
And that's another couple hundred vendors.
Now, to the uninitiated, to me, it's like driving around downtown Dallas. I don't know if I'm in Richardson or Arlington, right?
I mean, you don't really need to know.
Yeah, it's just all the Metroplex, and this is all, to me, it's the craft fair.
Yes.
Yes.
But there are actually three.
Sure, sure.
There used to be, I don't know if it's still there. I haven't been for a couple of years. Sharp Show at War Eagle used to have the best booth,
mm-hmm.
where the people took interesting things like bedpans mm-hmm. and turned them into art.
Yeah.
And every year, we looked forward to finding out what was going to be at that booth. Then there's the Frisco Station Mall Arts and Crafts Festival, not nearly as old, but also indoors.
That's in Rogers.
That's in Rogers. It's the 17th through the 20th. The It's Fall Y'all Craft Fair, which is my favorite saying for this year, Benton County Fairgrounds, 50 vendors. It's the 17th through the 20th. The Heart of Rogers Craft Fair, now in its fifth year, this may be the most unique. Oh, I just said most unique, and Catherine Sherrods will help me. This may be the most unusual of all of the crafts fairs. It happens at Haas Hall Academy and First United Methodist Church in Rogers. And while you're shopping, you can also take historic tours of Haas Hall and historic tours of the stained glass at the church.
Oh, cool.
So that's fun. That's the 18th and 19th. Is that all of them? Yes, that's the last one. So you can start on Wednesday, go through Sunday, spend a ton of money, eat a ton of funnel cakes. Please eat a funnel cake for me. I'm on another diet.
All right. Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 22nd Annual Pink Ribbon Luncheon is Wednesday, October 23rd at the Northwest Arkansas Convention Center in Springdale. Doors opening at 10:45 a.m. with lunch at 11:30. Lunch, silent auction, and Survivor fashion show are included in this special event. Proceeds to benefit Susan G. Komen Ozark, komenozark.org, or 750-PINK for information. The Arkansas Alumni Association encourages graduates to stay connected and give back. Membership in the Arkansas Alumni Association supports student scholarships and alumni programming. More information on membership and services available at arkansasalumni.org/join or 575-2801.
A $2.5 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education will allow the University of Arkansas Fort Smith to provide more academic support for students. The grant, announced this morning, is part of the Title III Strengthening Institutions Program and will enable UAFS to move forward with the creation of a dedicated campus writing center, as well as provide accelerated literacy programming through a summer program and support faculty in academic literacy teaching strategies. The 13th-ranked Arkansas soccer team moves into the last 2 weeks of the regular season with an 11-2-1 mark after defeating Mississippi State 6-1 yesterday in Fayetteville. With four conference matches left before the SEC tournament in Alabama, Arkansas is tied for second place in the SEC with a 5-1 conference mark. They're tied with Florida. South Carolina's in first at 5-0. Up next for Arkansas, Friday night match at Texas A&M. The lone remaining home match is Sunday, October 27th against Georgia. The John Brown University's men's soccer team's winning streak is now 6 after a weekend shutout of Oklahoma City University. JBU will host Oklahoma Panhandle State Thursday evening at 5 at Alumni Field in Siloam Springs. The JBU women will also play Oklahoma Panhandle State Thursday night. That match scheduled to begin at 7. The JBU women also recorded a weekend shutout of Oklahoma City University. They now have a 5-match winning streak. The JBU volleyball team, now 19-5 after winning 3 of 4 matches on the road this weekend. This approaching weekend, the team away from home again with a pair of matches in Texas. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith volleyball team will also travel south to Texas for a pair of matches this weekend, but will first be home tomorrow night for a matchup with Southern Arkansas in Stubblefield Center on the UAFS campus at 6. UAFS now 13-5 in 2019 after splitting a pair of home matches on Friday and Saturday. And the Razorback volleyball team still looking for an SEC win this season after losing in 5 sets at South Carolina yesterday afternoon. Arkansas 0-5 in the SEC, 6-11 overall. And tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, Washington County emergency managers say a new wireless emergency communication system for the county is needed.
Right now, we have holes in the county, if you will, where the radio would not work. And so that's the need for the infrastructure.
The story on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF. And tomorrow morning, during Morning Edition, you can learn more about the region with newscasts provided by Antoinette Grajeda. Antoinette is with you at 5:30 and 7:30 each weekday morning on KUAF.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Born April 15, 1936, in Auvergne in Jackson County, Frank Otis Frost became known as one of the premier Delta blues harmonica players of the latter part of the 20th century, with his talent sought for albums, motion pictures, and in concert around the world. Frank Frost, lay your bottle down. You drank all the time. Remembered as a harmonica player, Frank Frost learned singing and some piano early on in church. He also played guitar and later made keyboard another one of his main instruments. After graduating high school, Frank Frost began playing music with Sam Carr, and Carr would remain on and off again partners with Frost for the next half century. Sam Carr, now considered among the premier Delta blues drummers, is the son of slide guitar great Robert Nighthawk. Both father Nighthawk and son Carr were born in Helena. Frost and Carr also performed as Nighthawks. Meanwhile, Frost was influenced on harmonica by another Helena resident, Sonny Boy Williamson II, also known as Rice Miller. Frank Frost recorded one of only eight albums issued by Sam Phillips' record label, Phillips International. Phillips launched the label in 1957, feeling his Sun record label in Memphis had become too associated with rock and roll. Before Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Arkansas's Johnny Cash, Charlie Rich, and the like, Sun Records had gotten its start recording blues music in the early 1950s. I saw a place for Frank Frost, Sam Phillips later said, even though he was the most bluesy thing I had recorded in years. Phillips died in 2003. Hey, lonesome, so lonesome. The Phillips International record label didn't last, but Frost continued recording and playing the blues, most often with Sam Carr. Frost and Carr, with guitarist Big Jack Johnson, formed the Jelly Roll Kings in the 1970s. This blues supergroup would exist off and on over three decades. The 1979 Jelly Roll Kings album cover, Rockin' the Juke Joint Down, shows the trio in front of the Red Top Lounge in Clarksdale, Mississippi. The Jelly Roll Kings were a longtime house band at Clarksdale's Red Top Lounge, also known as Smitty's. Heard here is Frank Frost with the Jelly Roll Kings, produced by Little Rock native Robert Palmer with So Lonesome.
Whoa, I'm going away, baby. Well, I'll be back some old day. But right now, baby, I'm so lonesome. Sleeping all by myself.
Opening the program and that album, 1997's Off Yonder Wall, is Frank Frost Blues. Despite the song title, Frank Frost Blues was sung by Big Jack Johnson. Frank Frost's reputation as an authentic Delta blues musician solidified through the 1970s and 1980s, even as blues music's popularity rose and fell. In the mid-1980s, Frank Frost's fame had spread far enough that he was asked to contribute to the Hollywood movie Crossroads. Although it is a coming-of-age vehicle for actor Ralph Macchio, best known as the Karate Kid, there are some good musical moments in the 1986 film Crossroads. There are several additional songs which are not heard in the film and the Crossroads movie soundtrack, produced by Ry Cooter with help from Little Rock native Jim Dickinson. Frank Frost appears in the film and on the soundtrack. the 1990s, interest in the blues was again on the rise. Frank Frost, based out of his Helena apartment near his girlfriend's restaurant, Eddie May's Cafe, emerged in blues circles as a living legend. Gigs for Frost could mean in other countries or Japanese television as often as a Delta juke joint. The ever-growing popularity of the annual King Biscuit Blues Fest in Helena, renamed in 2005 as the Arkansas Blues and Heritage Fest, helped raise Frost statewide and international profile. But by 1999, at age 63, Frank Frost's health had deteriorated. Scheduled to perform at that year's October Festival with longtime partner Sam Carr, Frost was only able to wave to the crowd from his wheelchair. 4 days later, on October 12, 1999, Frank Frost died of congestive heart failure in his apartment. Frost is buried in Helena's Magnolia Cemetery, and the street in Helena where Frost lived is now called Frank Frost Street. Here is Frank Frost of Jackson County with his early 1960s Phillips International single, Jelly Roll King.
Oh, Brother Joe.
Frank Otis Frost of Auvergne in Jackson County with Jelly Roll King, his early 1960s Phillips International single. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Most autumn weekends right here pretty busy. The approaching one, no different. The Writers' Colony at Derry Hollow will host writer Ann Catherine Kelly as the featured reader during the next Poet Luck event Saturday. Local writers are invited to read after the featured writer. It's free and open to the public. You can find out more at the Writers' Colony Facebook page. Flower Garden and Nature Society of Northwest Arkansas will welcome Food Loops, an organization serving Benton and Washington counties. Food Loops' mission is to reduce food waste to zero as they offer a wide and viable, cost-effective recycling option plan. It takes place Saturday morning at 10 at Northwest Technical Institute in NTI Student Center in Springdale. For more, FGNS of Northwest Arkansas on Facebook. Contributors to this Monday edition of Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda, Zuzana Sitek, and Jacqueline Froelich. Jacqueline delivered news about flu shots for infants and toddlers. Timothy Dennis mastered our show. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Caitlin Ahrens, and it's produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at KUAF. Becca Martin Brown, the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, is a regular visitor to our Monday show. She's back Friday to offer suggestions for how to spend time for this upcoming third weekend of October. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. And you can hear more editions of Arkansongs with Stephen Cook at the Arkansongs Facebook page. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Mansfield. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. We are back at noon and 7 tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening.